Good morning, everyone. At this time, we open the day's coverage of the news of the world with direct reports from home and abroad. Our representatives are standing by at Batavia and London. And a little later in the program, we'll hear from Earl Godwin in Washington. This is the newsroom in San Francisco, taking you first to the Netherlands East Indies. Go ahead, Batavia.
This is Sidney Albright speaking in Batavia, Java. The time is 8:30 Tuesday evening. The latest communique of the Netherlands Indies Fighting Forces states that during an attack yesterday by Dutch bombers on Japanese ship concentrations near Tarakan, two direct hits were scored on two transport ships. In the course of the morning, Japanese aircraft made heavy raids on Colondale in the central Celebes, where approximately 30 heavy bombs were dropped. One non-commissioned officer was seriously wounded. Another air raid took place at Ternate on Halmahera Island, causing the death of 15 civilians. Four persons were seriously wounded and 20 slightly wounded. Copra and oil warehouses were set afire, while buildings in the center of the town were also burned. These fires have been extinguished, the communique concludes. The courageous garrison at Tarakan in Borneo was finally forced to surrender the city to the Japanese. An official communique says that the Japanese attack was carried out with far superior forces, eventually succeeding in breaking the resistance of the garrison. According to latest word received, radio communications with Tarakan were broken off in the early stages of the battle. Therefore, no particulars are known, as yet, as to the course of the fighting. A small portion of the garrison succeeded in escaping to the mainland, and it is expected that details of the attack and eventual surrender will be received in Batavia as soon as the escaped troops are able to establish communications with headquarters in Java. Air attacks on the Japanese fleet off Tarakan are being continued, and according to latest word, the enemy will pay dearly for its victory over the handful of troops comprising the Tarakan garrison. Very little information has been received about Allied participation in the attacks against the invading forces, but it is known that Allied planes yesterday shot down four Japanese planes over the Minahasa, while they scored two direct hits on a Japanese cruiser and a near miss on a destroyer. Two Australian planes were shot down in flames near Minato during the course of these operations. A supplementary communique issued last night tells of the success of Dutch army bombers in scoring a direct hit on a Japanese cruiser off Tarakan. Also two direct hits on transports at the same place. At Singapore, Dutch fighters shot down three enemy planes. One of the Dutch pilots was forced to bail out after accounting for two Japanese planes. He landed safely by parachute. Since the fall of Tarakan, it is thought that the Japanese will renew their attacks on the Minahasa and the Halmahera group of islands, eventually striking at New Guinea. These points form a rough line across the map of the Celebes Sea to the Pacific. Should the Japanese be successful in occupying points along this line, they will completely block the Pacific entrance to Java from the north. Although this appears to be one of the strategic moves in back of the present Japanese operations, there is very little importance attached to the fact, because actually, the Japanese have had virtual control over these waters since their occupation of Davao in the Philippines, from which point reconnaissance planes could effectively patrol the entire area. Without meaning to underrate the importance of the Japanese victory in Tarakan, it has always been the opinion of observers here that the small garrison in the city would not be able to hold the enemy at bay for any real length of time. The garrison exceeded even the most optimistic estimates. This penetration into the Dutch first line of defense is just a scratch on the surface. The Japanese will find in further moves towards Java that they are just getting into the fight. I return you now to San Francisco.
From San Francisco, we take you now to the newsroom in New York. Now, before we go abroad again, here's a story from Moscow. The communist organ Pravda says the Russian troops reoccupied 11 towns on an unidentified section of the front yesterday in fierce fighting, during which nearly 2,000 enemy soldiers were killed or wounded.
Several hundred Finnish officers and men are said to have been among the casualties. And from Berlin comes word that for the first time in quite a while, the Germans give some specific figures today on their battle in Russia. The high command communique says the German soldiers killed 219 Russians and captured 93 others in raids east of Kharkov. Now, Kharkov is an industrial city in the Donetsk Basin, 400 miles south of Moscow, and today's communique contains the first mention of German offensive action in the southern sector in many a day. Now, overseas again, this time across the Atlantic, for news from England.
This is London. John McVane speaking. Authoritative quarters in London today refuse to comment on Singapore reports about sensational developments. If and when air reinforcements become available, there are plenty of aerodromes on Singapore Island, the Malayan mainland, Sumatra, and Java. Accommodations for naval and military forces on Singapore are well known. It's known here that bitter fighting is continuing in Malaya, but there aren't any real details yet. Representatives of 9 occupied European countries today solemnly declared that punishment will be visited on the Germans and the Quislings who have committed crimes against the conquered peoples. The delegates met in Old St. James's Palace in London. They sat at a long, red baize-covered table. Spotlights blazed on them. From the walls, a whole assemblage of kings and queens of England looked down on the gathering. At one end, Henry VIII, legs apart. At the other, what looked like a youthful picture of Queen Victoria. The delegates all sat along one side of the table, with their chairman, General Sikorsky of Poland, in the center. Opposite were Anthony Eden, British Foreign Minister, Anthony Biddle, American ambassador to most of the countries represented, and observers from Russia, China, the British Dominions, and India. Most of the talking was in French. The declaration that the 9 nations had drawn up was a simple one. It charged that Germany had instituted in the occupied countries a regime of terror, imprisonments, mass expulsions, execution of hostages, and massacres. It recalled that the Hague Convention doesn't permit this sort of thing. Then it said that among their principal war aims, the 9 countries place the punishment of those guilty and responsible for the crimes, whether they've ordered them, perpetrated them, or in any way participated in them. The 9 countries will see to it that the guilty will be sought for and handed over to justice. The 4 great powers, America, Britain, Russia, and China, were present only as observers, though the Chinese minister did make public a note declaring that the principles of the declaration would be applied to the Japanese occupying authorities in China when the time comes. Mr. Eden welcomed the delegates. He said the meeting showed the so-called German New Order was a sham and that it brought a message of courage to the oppressed peoples. Only 2 of the delegates were in uniform, General Sikorsky, the chairman, and General de Gaulle, representative of France. Sikorsky pointed out that the declaration expresses a new principle of international law, the united repression of acts that in peacetime would be considered common law crimes, and which won't go unpunished because of the pretext that they were committed in war. Sikorsky said, "There is no crime without punishment." That was the keynote of the meeting. Delegate after delegate spoke in support. Pierlot of Belgium, de Gaulle of France, Souderos of Greece, Beck of Luxembourg, and all the rest. Norway, the Netherlands, Czechoslovakia, and Yugoslavia. From time to time, we reporters, crowded at one end of the room behind the red velvet rope, could hear the whir of movie cameras recording the scene. The delegates spoke without any great emotion. They seemed more like judges reading a sentence in a court of law. What they said was only a bare hint at what they meant. In 5 minutes, you couldn't tell what the Germans have done to the people of Poland, the people of Yugoslavia, or the Czechs. Once in a while, a speaker would say something that brought you the picture. The Greek said, for instance, "Crete has been devastated from end to end. Many villages have been deliberately burned and razed to the ground." In Macedonia, he went on, "Flourishing towns have been destroyed by the Bulgarian forces. Many thousands of innocent victims have been done to death, and more than 100,000 driven from their homes." The story was always the same. The Yugoslavs said, "Hundreds of thousands of Yugoslavs have been forced to abandon their homes. Entire localities have been destroyed, and their inhabitants almost completely massacred." Tiny Luxembourg's delegate said German prisons were filled with Luxembourg patriots. He said, "Loyalty to one's country is considered as treachery." This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Now, next we turn to this nation's capital and a report by Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. The spectacular announcement so quietly made by the tall, white-haired, soft-spoken Jesse Jones, a loan administrator, and incidentally a heavy hand in constructive wartime policy here in Washington and for the United Nations, is enough to start you throwing your hats in the air and yipping like a lot of cowboys off on a whoopee party this morning. For Jesse Jones, Lens announces the loan of $400 million of RFC cash or credit or whatever it is they use for money to various oil and rubber and chemical companies, which have been at work a long time developing synthetic rubber. That's just rubber that comes out of a chemical tube instead of a tree. And they're ready now to put the stuff out in big quantities if they get the money. The rubber comes from some sort of an oil ingredient, and if they have no setbacks now with this $400 million in hand for plants and so forth, there can be produced two-thirds of America's needs in rubber by the middle of next year, 18 months, says Jesse Jones. Really, I think this is the biggest news of the war so far to millions of Americans who thought a few weeks ago that the biggest world news that ever happened was that they couldn't get any more rubber tires. It certainly seems to protect American life from that tremendous and destructive shock. And if necessity is the mother of invention, I nominate Jesse Jones this morning to the post of Mother's Helper. Incidentally, that $400 million program is designed to produce, I think it's five times as much rubber as Germany and some of its German allies can get a year. The artificial rubber is going to cost about 30 cents a pound. That's 10 cents higher than the present natural rubber price, but there's an awful lot of people that'll be perfectly willing to pay 10 cents a pound or whatever it is if they could get a new tire. You know, this war wipes out the old and lays down the new conditions too fast to be realized by most of us. America's not being thought of as a military success around the world, by our enemies at least, but the old role of banker for one and all is being prepared for this government, I believe. Loans the like of which have not been seen can be expected. You may hear of a $500 million loan for China to keep Chinese currency from collapsing and causing widespread Chinese dissatisfaction, making the people of China, or part of China, an easy prey to Japanese fifth column suggestions as to why should Japan and China fight each other when they could join and fight the United States and the British Empire in a fight to keep the United States and the British Empire out of Asia. That is one of the appalling suggestions. The president calls congressmen to the White House to talk over the price control bill, which is now in a condition to be vetoed by the president, I should imagine. It is far afield from the price control the president envisioned. It controls no labor. It boosts farm prices. It is said to boost finished food product prices to 30%. At any rate, the president is trying to block a move to give his own Secretary of Agriculture price control over farm products. That's in the bill, but Secretary of Agriculture Wickard has not yet come out with a flat, "I don't want it." A Republican leader last night advocated Herbert Hoover as price controller. The advocate was smiling Joe Martin, Massachusetts congressman and chairman of the Republican National Committee. He said Hoover would radiate more public confidence than those now in price control, and that is all from Washington at this time.
Thank you, Will Godwin. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the news at home and abroad as reported by staff members on the scene. Now, you've heard Sidney Albright from Batavia, Java, John McVain from London, and Earl Godwin from Washington. It's a pretty good idea to keep tuned to this station for the latest news. This is the Blue Network.